All right, good afternoon. Well, still morning. Okay, we're in morning. It is Thursday morning. It is 10:25 now, and we're here in Chem 3. And like I said, today what I want to do is go back and look at ions for a minute because we missed that part. I didn't see it in the text. And it's showing up in the problem sets that I chose, which just goes to show that I didn't read the problem set as efficiently as I needed to do, but that's what happens when you put a problem set together at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And ions usually show up in the electron configuration section in chapter 3. That is the natural place to discuss and introduce ions because you're starting to talk about electrons and ions have to do with electrons. That's why they usually show up in that spot. So I didn't think to introduce them here, and I didn't see them in my reading myself when I read the chapters. And I actually went back through and looked at the chapters a second time, and I still didn't see it. So I'm not exactly certain why they're showing up in the homework set as much as they are. But I would naturally introduce them in chapter 3, so this is a perfect intro into that. So let's introduce them a little bit now. And then we'll bring them back heavily into chapter 3 as well. And I got a message from somebody on an iPhone in the chat who doesn't have a name on it. And I will reply to that message in a minute because that's going to take me a bunch of typing. So I'll reply on the break to that message and give you the best time for office hours. Or actually, I can just say it. Office hours are always every day, Monday through Thursday, from 3:30 to 5:15. That's the best time to get help with that during office hours. Outside of that, through email is the best way to get help. So those two things. And I'm really good at replying on email too, because I can send files back and forth through email, and they're handwritten files with all the, it's not just a text of an email. I can send all the graphical elements that I would in an answer to be really helpful. So email can also work really well that way. But office hours, 3:30, to 5:15 daily, that is one of the best places to be able to get support and get help with those things, okay? I think I'm screen sharing, yes. Okay, and I got a new window up, and let's just talk ions for a real quick second here. An ion, this is an element. With more or less electrons than the number of protons. There are a bunch of chemical reactions where elements can lose electrons or gain electrons. Electrons can be traded like currency for the elements. That is the currency of elements, essentially, is the electrons. And because electrons can be gained or lost, when we have a neutral element, something like, let's see, what did I do this morning, but I want to do something different. So let's do this one. Actually, I did do that one this morning too. Oh, all these things I did already. Let's do iodine. Iodine, when we look at the number of protons and the number of electrons, iodine is element number 53. So its atomic number is 53. That means that it has 53 protons. And when it's neutral, 53 electrons. Remember that the protons are the positively charged ones. So that's 53 positive charges. And the electrons are the negatively charged one. So that's 53 negatives. And that means that the net charge is equal to zero. So this one has zero charge, and when it's a zero, we typically don't display it. This is a neutral element. But sometimes these elements can gain or lose electrons. And when they gain an electron, if we add an electron into it, now there is a difference between the numbers of electrons and protons. So the number of protons is still 53. That is unchanging and cannot be altered. Otherwise, it would change the element that we're dealing with. So the element number stays the same, 53. But the number of electrons now is 54, because we have added in an electron. So that means that I have 54 negative charges, and that means that I have a net charge of minus one. That gets demonstrated up here at the top, where the charge goes on the element. And now this is called an ion. And it is an ion because it possesses a charge, a lesser or greater number of electrons than the total number of protons. So this has one more electron than the total number of protons, and this is an ion. Now, when we name ions, ions can be of two different types. They can be a cation, or they can be an anion. A cation is a positive ion, and it results from less electrons than total protons. And an anion is a negative, and it results from more electrons. Than the total protons. And so we can have cations and anions, and examples of those, some anions to show you. Some anions are things like oxygen with a 2 minus, nitrogen with a 3 minus, fluoride with a 1 minus. So anions typically have between a minus 1 minus 2 and minus 3 are typical charges for anions. Cations have a greater diversity of charges that we normally see. These are things like sodium with a positive, or iron with 3 positives, or we could look at cobalt with a 2 positive, or chromium with a 6 positive. In fact, positives usually can go from positive 1 to 2 positives all the way up to 7 positives. Some of the elements can have 7 positives, such as manganese can have a 7 positive charge on it. And so those are some examples of cations. And if we are given a charge, we can work backwards. For instance, let's look at that manganese that I said was 7 positives. If we look at the periodic table and we find manganese on the periodic table, it is element number 25. So that 25, when I look at the number of protons and then figure out the number of electrons, that 25 tells me here that there are 25 protons, and that equals 25 positive charges. So in order to figure out how many electrons there are, I need to take and subtract from that 25 the 7 positive charges. So to find the number of electrons, you take the 25 protons and subtract from it the 7 positive charge. That's going to equal what? 18? Yeah. 18 electrons. The 18 electrons, when I take and I say, all right, there are now 25 positive charges and 18 negative charges, and the result of adding those together should be the 7 positive, which is the net charge. And so that's how we can go through and we can find out how many electrons there actually are. It's just an imbalance between the protons and the electrons, but we have to adjust the number of electrons. We never change the number of protons. Because the number of protons, that is determining what element it is. And if you change the number of protons, then you're looking at a different element. Does that make sense in terms of that? So we're always just altering or changing the number of electrons, and we can work forwards or backwards. We can tell you how many electrons are gained or lost, and you can tell us where the charge is, or we could give you the charge. You look up and you find the atomic number for the element. Once you find the atomic number, then you can adjust the number of electrons to get that resulting charge. So that's ions in a nutshell. And in the next chapter, in chapter 3, we'll see why they gain and lose electrons. And that's the more important thing, because from the periodic table, we can actually tell how many electrons will be gained or lost and what the charge on an ion will be from the periodic table. So that's coming up in this next section in chapter 3. Okay. So let's start with that. Let's start with chapter 3. And I can't remember what the title of chapter 3 is, but I think it's electronic configurations. Okay, normally what I do is I highlight out which chapter I'm doing, chapter 3.1, chapter 3.2, chapter 3.3. And in chapter three is written from more of a Chem 1A standpoint. Chapter three is written with a tremendous amount of information, which is all good information, which is, it's all really valuable, but it's more than I usually like to do within Chem 3. I like to do Chem 3 at sort of a lower level of understanding. And so while they give you wave equations and they give you amplitude and period and all of these things for electromagnetic radiation, I think that's all good, but I'm going to simplify chapter 3 dramatically. And so when I put together the chapter 3 homework and the chapter 3 reading, I'm going to target very specific parts of chapters or just specific chapters and simplify chapter 3 dramatically. So when you're reading chapter 3, or if you've been reading ahead, just be careful and look at what I'm going to put online real quick here tonight about what it is that I want you to focus on and what I want you to read. Okay, so chapter 3, electronic configurations. This tends to be a challenging material for chapter 3, for Chem 3. It's difficult in its very abstract and very not tangible. It is hard to understand electronic configurations because, number one, it's not a man-made system. It's not a system that we made. It is something that is observed. And number two, it's complicated in its structure, and it just is, and that's the way Mother Nature made it. So what I like to say about this is that it is very common to be confused with this material while the lecture is going on, and it is very common to be confused until even the end of the lecture and sometimes even the next lecture before it starts to make sense or starts to come together. And that's okay. We all get there eventually. It's just a matter of how much time do we have to wrestle with it to get where we need to go. And number two is that there's a lot of why questions. Why is it this way? And the why question of why is it this way is sort of akin to asking why does a tree flower with a specific color, or why does it grow in a specific way? That those questions are not easily answered questions, that they're more about the nature of the object. And that as we start talking about electronic configurations, I liken it to looking at a sculpture and trying to understand the sculpture in the way the sculpture looks, not in why the author made it the way they did. Why did Mother Nature invent this system or make this system? That's a very challenging question to answer. But we can appreciate the system, and we can learn about the system and understand the system, and that's what we're going to try to do. So with that in mind, let's look at a couple of experiments and start to understand some of these experiments. First of all, when we look at electromagnetic radiation, And that's where we're going to start, is we're going to look at electromagnetic radiation. In electromagnetic radiation, we span the gap of looking at energy and how energy propagates as a wave. And so energy, as it propagates, that is not the best wave that I've ever drawn. I'm going to try one more time. Energy exists as a wave. And that wave has what we call a period. And it has, if we think about this as a midline, it has what we call an amplitude. And the amplitude is the height of the wave. The energy of a wave is related to its period. The smaller the period, the higher the energy.
Because it's moving more?
That's a good question. Is it because it's moving more? They all move at the same speed. They all move at the same speed of light. So the electromagnetic radiation, in terms of the speed at which it is moving at the speed of light. But what we do is we relate the period of the wave, what we call the wavelength. So this period is also what we call the wavelength. And the wavelength is inversely proportional to its energy, so that the smaller the wavelength, the more energetic it is, the more cycles per second. I guess you could think of it that way. So the more cycles per second there is, the higher the energy. So in a way, yes, it's moving more because it's more cycles per second. So I think that's fair to say, or that's a fair
assessment. But not necessarily faster.
Not necessarily faster, correct, because light is all moving, or electromagnetic radiation is all moving at the speed of light in a vacuum. So they're moving at the same speed, but we get more cycles per second, which means more energy per second, is a way to say that. So that's a fair assessment. Okay, and when we look at these, we have very high energy, very low energy. And these very high energy particles, we say, are things like X-rays. And low energy, over here, we have radio waves. And I wish I had the amplitudes or the wavelengths in order to give them to you. I don't have them on the top of my head, but in the middle here, we have what we call the visible spectrum. And that visible spectrum runs from a wavelength that on the high energy side is up around 750 nanometers. And goes down to about 450 nanometers in terms of its wavelength size. And when you get out, so on the low energy side is blue. And I'm doing this the reverse of what the way I normally do it, but this side of the spectrum is blue. And as you get up into very high energies, this side of the spectrum is red. And then we have every color sort of in between there in terms of their wavelengths. And as we go to low wavelengths, we go into ultraviolet. Those are wavelengths that are below 450 nanometers. And as we go above 750 nanometers, we go into infrared. And so we have this sort of continuum of electromagnetic radiation that takes us from very low energy radio waves through ultraviolet up into the visible spectrum, and then into infrared, and then into higher energies. So that's where we go. And below ultraviolet, well, that's our UV energy. That's what I want to do. Okay, that's enough for what I need to do here. What I want to look at is an experiment that if we take an atom, and it doesn't matter which one we take, but let's look at hydrogen. And we have this electron cloud that sits around the hydrogen and the nucleus. The electron, if we think about the nucleus is where the charge is. So this is where the positive charge is. And the electron cloud, this is where the negative charge is. And there is an attractive force between the electrons and the nucleus. And that attractive force gives or imparts to the electron a certain amount of potential energy, that the potential energy is relative to the distance that the electron is away from the nucleus. So we can think about this distance from the nucleus as being relative to the potential energy of the electron. And what I can do is I can send energy in, and that electron can pick up energy. So if
I
start—
Can you go back up for 1 second? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. So what I'm going to do with this picture is I'm going to excite the electron. I'm going to give the electron more energy. I'm going to add energy to the electron. And when I do that, the electron is going to absorb energy. And as it does, it is literally going to move the electron farther away from the nucleus. So what we do is we take, and our electron is sitting here, and we add energy to it by shining light on it. So this is a symbol that we'll use for light. And as we hit that electron with light, it can absorb that energy. And as it absorbs that energy, what it does is it goes to a greater distance away from the nucleus. So there's my nucleus, and my electron now is excited. So we'll say this is an excited electron. And it has, and by excited we mean it has more energy.
What does the 2R mean again?
The 2R, it's not really a 2R, it's a symbol that is a lambda and a V that is sort of an italicized V. One stands for the wavelength and one stands for the frequency. And they are how light, they are symbols that we use for light.
So basically you're saying when more light hits the electron, then the electron gets excited and it moves away from the nucleus.
Yeah. So essentially, just like you pick up a rock and you place a rock on a shelf, the act of placing the rock on the shelf is taking and using energy. You are supplying the energy and you are increasing the potential energy of the rock by placing it on the shelf. So for moving it from one location to another location, you are increasing the potential energy of that object. We do the same thing with the electron, but we do it through light. So as light energy comes in, the electron absorbs that energy and goes to a higher energy state. It has more potential energy, because it is farther away from the nucleus now. And then what happens is the electron...
That's a question, sir?
Yeah, go for it.
What is that symbol called one more time?
This one is lambda. And the other one is nu. N-U? I can't remember how to spell nu. I think it's N-U. So one is lambda and one is nu. And they are Greek symbols. One standing for the wavelength and one standing for the frequency. And so this electron, when it's in this excited state, it doesn't stay in this excited state for very long. It will stay in this excited state. Well, it's hard to say exactly how long because it's a random thing of how long it takes for it to actually fall. But what happens is the electron will fall back to its regular state. And when it does, it will release energy that is proportional to the distance. So energy then comes out of this, and the energy that comes out is proportional to the distance the electron fell. And so what we do is we do an experiment where we create what's called a gas discharge tube. And the gas discharge tube looks a bit like this. We take a tube and this tube has a closed off ends. And inside this, we put two electrodes, one which is positive and one which is negative. We evacuate the tube and take all the gas out of the tube. And so there was a couple of little ports that were on the tube that allowed us to be able to suck all the gas out of the tube, suck all the air out. And then once all the air was sucked out of the tube, then we put a specific gas back in the tube, like hydrogen gas. And then we take this thing and we run this thing through a little box that plugs into the wall. And we can then change the voltage that is passed through this positive cathode, positive and a negative cathode. And we then throw energy across this. And as we throw energy across this, electrons fly through it and energy is absorbed by the atoms. And then energy is released. And this light glows. And as the light glows, we take the light that comes out of this object and we pass it through a prism. And the prism splits it into individual wavelengths. And so what we get out of this is we get individual wavelengths that come out. We get a very deep sort of purple line. Actually, I want to use the highlighter. So the lines that we get out of this, we get a purple line, we get a blue line, we get a green line, and then up here there's a red line. And there are four different wavelengths that wind up coming out of this. And this is what we call a line spectrum. And each one of these wavelengths is associated with a particular energy. So each one of these wavelengths has an energy associated with it. We'll say that this equals an amount of energy. Now in Chem 1A, what you do is you actually go through and measure the wavelength, and then you use the formulas to convert that wavelength into energy. And then we can actually calculate how much energy the electron has undergone through that transition. But the important part of this is that let's hypothetically say that the electron could go to any distance that it wanted to from the nucleus, so that the electron could fall in any increment or any size increment that it wanted to fall. If that were true, then I would get every single wavelength possible, and what I would see would be a continuum. I would see a rainbow. Does that make sense? That if the electron could obtain any distance from the nucleus that it wanted to, that that electron then could fall through every single possible distance, and every possible distance would then result in every frequency of light, and therefore I would see a continuum or a rainbow in terms of what happens. But I don't see that. I don't see a continuum or a rainbow when I split the light out from this. What I see is very specific wavelengths of light that come out. So what does that mean? What that means is that the electron can't go anywhere it wants to, that the electron has essentially shelves inside the atom, and that there is structure to the atom. That's essentially what this experiment tells us. So this experiment is called the gas discharge tube.
Are the limits of the electrons the valence shells?
In a way, what we're saying is that if we're looking at the atom and the nucleus is here, that there are certain locations that the electron can go, and that the electron cannot go anywhere it wants to, but there are only specific locations where the electron can go. The electron can be here, or here, or here, or out of the outer ring, but it can't be in between. So the electron has specific locations where it can go.
I was just curious if those locations where it can go, like those circles you just drew, had anything to do with the valence shells.
Yes and no. Valence is a word that we use that means outermost. And so,
oh, right.
In a way, yes, valence meaning outermost locations and shell being a location where the electron can go. Yes, those can mean valence, but valence in another sense, when we look at electron configurations, we use that word in a slightly different way. So what I would say is that these aren't valence shells exactly, but what they are is that these are orbitals. They are locations, and we use that word orbital. These are locations where the electron can reside. And even that isn't exactly correct. We're gonna even improve that a little bit. But that's what this experiment is telling us, is this experiment is telling us that there is structure within the element. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is that there is structure. In the atom, and that the electron resides within this structure. And that's what we're going to learn about, is that structure. And that is what is called electronic structure. So we're going to look at that electronic structure and see what the structure is within the atom. And that's the next part that we need to go and do, is we need to start that electronic structure. Yeah, go for it.
So then for your drawing that has the orbital locations.
Yes.
Right there. Would those orbits also be the purple and blue and green and red?
Yes. You do
with the line spectrum?
In a way, they are not actually the colors, but what they represent is they represent the transition of the electron from one to another that results in a color. So, for instance, we could say that if an electron falls from the outer level to this level here, that the light that would come out would be one of those wavelengths. Let's say that that's the red wavelength of light that comes out when the electron makes that transition or falls that distance. So it is not that the orbital gives it color, it is the distance between the orbitals that results in the color. When the electron falls from one orbital to another, when it reduces itself in its potential energy, the energy has to go someplace. That energy that has been lost is lost as light. And that light—
What's the action?
Let's say when you have an object, and the classic example is a pendulum, and a pendulum starts off over here at a specific height, and we drop that pendulum, and so at some point that object is now sitting here, and then it swings over to the other side as it continues its swing. Here, it has potential energy before you release it. And as you release it, it goes into motion. And as it is into motion, it is going through and converting the potential energy into kinetic energy. And so the energy total of the system is equal to the potential energy plus the kinetic energy. And so right here at the bottom, it has lost all of its potential energy, and it only has kinetic energy at the bottom. And then as it goes back up into its swing, it converts the kinetic energy back up into potential energy. And at some point it stops, and all it has is potential energy again. And so the potential energy and the kinetic energy are trading off as it goes. So we could think of what happened here as the electron falls. If we think about this as the electron falls, the energy that was released from potential energy is converted into light. And it comes off as light, and I see it as light. Another way to think about that is, let's say that I take a rock, and a rock is dropped from a height. It has potential energy at this height, and at the point where it falls down here to the ground, the potential energy goes to zero. Well, what happened to all that potential energy? Where did all that energy do? What did it do? It came off as energy, heat, and sound that was created when the rock fell and hit the ground. And so the sound that comes off of this and the heat that is generated is the amount of kinetic energy that came off the system. It was the energy that was lost. For us, that energy is lost as light. And we observe that energy as light, and then we can back calculate how far the electron actually fell between these energy levels based on how much energy that light has.
That makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so is it the transition that gives off color? Yes, it is. It is the electronic transition that gives off color. That is absolutely correct. And what's really cool about this is that this line spectrum is unique to what element it is that you investigate. Every element has its own line spectrum. And the line spectrum is like a fingerprint for that element, such that you can actually look at the spectrum of any light and you can tell what element is giving rise to that light, or combinations of elements is giving rise to that light. So we could take a spectrophotometer and shine it at a light bulb, break up the light coming from that light bulb into individual wavelengths, and we could tell you what elements are in the filament that is giving rise to that light? Or what elements are painted on the outside of the light bulb that the light is shining through that is giving rise to that? In the same way that we could look at a sun and we can tell you the composition of the sun and what elements are in that sun, because we can take the light from the sun and break it up into its individual fingerprints, and we can tell how much hydrogen, how much helium, how much oxygen, how much neon is in that sun based on the breakdown of that light coming out of that sun. Not only that, we could take light coming from a sun passing through a cloud, like a cloud of gas in space, and we could tell the elements that are in that cloud in space by how they interact with the light, which is really kind of cool. So all of that is part of what we're investigating. I've been talking for about an hour. How about we take a break and we'll come back and we'll start to build this electronic structure? Sound like a good deal? All right, 10 minute break. We'll come back at about 11:15 and we'll talk some more electronic structure.
This is just a personal question, but for the quiz, you're going over like the answers or whatever to make sure that the Canvas thing doesn't
absolutely. There was an error in the Canvas on the quiz, and I need to go back over everybody's, but I was waiting to do it once, and so I was trying to wait until almost all the submissions were in, so I haven't done it yet. So it's sitting there, and it's waiting for me to go through and grade it and check it. And awesome. Even in my grade book, it's not even putting in a grade because I had you guys do a submission component, and until I review those submissions and actually approve the grade, no grade shows in my grade book yet. So it's showing me everybody who's completed it, but I haven't fixed the grades yet. So while you see a grade, I don't see a grade yet until I go through and do it for everybody. So rest assured that I will check absolutely everybody's, because otherwise the grade won't show in my grade book.
Cool. And then also just a general question is that, or not that general, but because on the quiz there was like a certain number of boxes where you had to like show like your roadmap or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, for example, for mine, it wasn't that amount of boxes. It was like one less, but it's perfectly fine to not have the same amount, right?
Yes and no. Yes, in that there is a way to create a roadmap that bypassed one or two of the boxes. No, in that I was asking you to use certain specific conversion factors that I was asking you to memorize, the three keys. And if you used the three keys, then that meant that you would have had to go through seven conversion factors to get there. So that will be fixed in me looking at your work that you submitted on paper. And I'll be able to look at it and see whether it's correct or not, and what roadmap you actually used. So that's another way that
ones we're supposed to memorize. Then would that be points off, or is that okay?
I don't know yet. I'll have to think about that. We'll look and see. I don't know, but if it's points off, it's like a fraction of a point. It's not even an entire point.
Oh, sick. All right.
So I wouldn't stress over it.
Yeah, no, I was just like.
No worries. All right. So I'll get to it. And the answer is yes. I'll sort that out in terms of points and what I feel that needs to look like. Okay. Break. We'll come back about 11:15-ish. All right. I'm going to put some music on here.
Rather than frowning aloud to people I might meet. But if it were up to you, would you look at it the same? The same way that I do? Or would you close your eyes and have no voice of opinion of what lies before you? 'Cause I say, whoa, something's gotta give. I need a simple life to live. Whoa, oh, look into yourself. You best find a better way to measure well. 'Cause I say, simple, it's a simple life for a simple race. Beneath the stars, well, we find our place. Well, it's a simple love, I wanna spread your way. Well, it's a simple life, just living it day to day, yeah. Well, I prefer climbing rather than falling from a tree. Well, I prefer singing rather than whispering silently. But if it were up to you, would you look at it the same way that I do? Or would you close your eyes and have no voice of opinion of what lies before you? Cause I say, whoa, oh, something's gotta give. I need a simple life to live. I say, whoa, look into yourself. You best find a better way to measure well. And I say, well, it's a simple life for a simple race. Beneath the stars, that's where we find our place. Well, it's a simple love, I wanna spread your way. Well, it's a simple life, we're just living it day to day, rather than acting helplessly. And I prefer living. Man, ain't that the way? Ain't that the way it's supposed to be? But if it were up to you, would you look at it the same way that I do? Or would you close your eyes and have no voice of opinion of what lies before you? Cause I say, whoa, oh, something's gotta give. I need a simpler life to live. Whoa, oh, look into yourself.
Taking my frown to a far distant town.
thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because
coming back. I had to fade out the music there, so I'm figuring this stuff out. Oh, and I lost my glasses. Shoot. I thought I left them in the other room. Okay, I'm back. And microphone's on. We stop this share. We go back to the screen share. Start. And back to this. And we're back on. Okay. So what we're going to do, I'll turn this camera back on too so you guys can see me. There we are. What we're going to do is we're going to look at this electronic configuration, and it's going to be in stages and steps. But before I do this, I want to talk about an experiment that is done. This is a little bit hard to explain too. When we get down to things that are as small as electrons, electrons do not behave like regular matter. Electrons are so tiny that Newtonian physics breaks down and quantum mechanics takes over. So we're at the level where Newtonian physics breaks down and quantum mechanics takes over. And that word quantum, that's an important word. And what does quantum mean? Quantum simply means discrete allowed amount of energies. So if you think about what it was, the experiment that I was explaining, and how the energy that comes out of, I'm going to go grab a picture. This is a picture that I had done earlier, and I was just drawing before. Let's grab this picture and throw it in here. That this experiment, which was our gas discharge tube. What the gas discharge tube does is it gives us these spectral lines, which when we say discrete, this word discrete here is telling me about these lines, that these lines can't be anywhere, that I get very specific allowed amounts of energy. And that's what discrete means. And that's literally what quantum means. So when we talk about quantum mechanics, what we're talking about is discrete energy, discrete amounts of energy. And another experiment that demonstrates this that is really quite kind of cool too is called a sand shaker table. And this you can Google as well, which is really kind of cool. So this is an experiment. Which demonstrates the nature of these discrete energy levels. What we do is we take a shaker table. So this thing is set up, it's a metal plate. And it's got a thing that vibrates it essentially. And what we do is we put sand on the plate or filings on the plate, metal filings. And then we vibrate the plate and put it, put energy into it and vibrate the plate. And what we find is that the plate will make certain patterns. What we will get is we will get the filings, which will combine in different areas of the plate. And they will move off of other areas. And what this demonstrates, if we increase the amount of energy and we add more energy, what it demonstrates is that there are certain frequencies that are allowed. And this time the pattern changes and gets even more complicated. And so what we wind up seeing is that the pattern will change and we'll get different patterns that come out of it. Each one of these patterns is a discrete amount of energy. Here's another experiment. We call it a standing wave. So these, actually what these are standing waves. And when we look at a standing wave, another sort of form of these standing waves is to take a jump rope, hold a jump rope at two ends. And when you swing the jump rope swings back and forth. If we put a little bit more energy into the jump rope can swing in another pattern where the jump rope goes this way. And if we put more energy into it yet, the jump rope can go in this pattern. And each one of these are an energy level. So we can think about these as energy levels. The jump rope can only swing in certain patterns because of its fixed nature at two different ends. And we would call this energy level 0, energy level 1, energy level 2, that the energy levels come in discrete whole numbers, and that the energy levels are denoted by these locations here and here and here, where the rope crosses the what was essentially the x-axis here. And the number of times that the rope crosses the x-axis is in whole numbers. You can't have a fraction of the number of times that it crosses the x-axis. You can only have whole numbers. And so in the first one, we see that it never crosses the x-axis in the way that the rope swings. And so that's our zero, our ground state. The rope can swing where one side goes up and down and the other side goes up and down. And here in the center, it always stays at zero. And that location is called a node. So this location here is called a node, and it denotes the number of the energy level. Notice that there are two nodes in the second energy level as I look at that. If I go to energy level 3 and I think about it this way, there will be three nodes. So I'll have to go up, down, up, back up, and in. And I go across and hit three nodes, and that would be energy level 3. These are what are called standing waves. And they have discrete, specifically allowed energy levels. So that word discrete is specifically allowed quantized energy levels. So these two experiments, the shaker table and this experiment that we can do with a rope, allows us to be able to demonstrate what is called a standing wave and this quantized energy. Is this what string theory is based on? Not exactly. Oh, it's just because I'm using strings. String theory is something different. String theory is much more complicated. String theory is one of my favorite things to read about too. But no, string theory is that all matter at the very fundamental smallest level, at what we call the Planck level, is made up of strings, hypothetical strings. And that's something different. This is using a string to symbolize standing waves, but string theory, this is not string theory. That is something completely different from this. Okay, and so what we're going to say here is that the electrons are going to behave in this way. The electrons are going to behave such that these energy levels that the electron can obtain is going to be denoted by these whole numbers, essentially, and that the electron can only obtain certain energies, and when it does, the electron will have certain patterns associated with it, and that pattern is associated with an energy. That's where we're going with this. So what this does is this demonstrates the idea of quantized energy, and the electrons have quantized energy associated with them. Okay, to go into this next part, we are going to
define... What does quantized energy mean?
So quantized, when we say quantized, that goes back to quantum. Quantum means discrete, only specific allowed amounts of energy. So that goes back to quantum, and quantized are sort of the same word there. Quantum meaning discrete amounts of allowed energy, quantized meaning possessing a discrete amount of energy. Okay, so we're going to introduce some new variables. Electrons are defined by four quantum numbers. The quantum numbers are n, lowercase n. This is the principal quantum number. We then have a lowercase l. This is the azimuthal quantum number. I always have trouble with this word. Azimuthal quantum number. This number is representing the orbital angular momentum, is really what that word means. Orbital angular momentum. We have an m, a lowercase m, that has a subscripted l. This is called the magnetic quantum number. and MS, which is the spin quantum number. And each one of these numbers, the electron takes on these four different quantum numbers, and they are represented in this way, N, L, M sub L, and M sub S. And this is how the electron is described. Every electron has a unique set of the four numbers. No two electrons can have the same four numbers. Each electron must be unique.
Hey, Jason, Marisol asked a good question. In the book, one of those is called angular quantum number. Which one is the angular?
Right here. That's the orbital angular momentum. That is the angular quantum number. Either name is okay, Marisol, yes. Okay, so each one of these variables can take on a specific value. So when we look at the specific values that these variables can take on, remember that each one of these words has a specific word in it that I want to highlight. Quantum. 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 That each one of these variables is quantized, meaning that they can only take on certain values. And so we're going to look at the values that these guys can take on. The principal quantum number. The principal quantum number, N, can have values of 1, 2, 3, and so on. It can only take on integer values. No fractional values are allowed. So these are allowable values. The azimuthal quantum number, L, L can take on integers from 0 2 n minus 1. So it can take on all the integer values from 0 to n minus 1, up to, I should say. When I say 2, I really should say up to n minus 1. And we're going to show examples of all of these. So right now we're just making some definitions.
Why is it up to n minus 1? Does that minus not indicate a negative number?
If, for instance, if n is 1, then mm-hmm. L can only take on 0 because it can only go up to n minus 1. If n is 2, then L can take on 0 and 1, but can't go up to 2 because it can only go up to n minus 1. If n is 3, so allowed values, what we can do is we can say, all right, each one of these values, n is determining L. So if n equals 1, if n equals 2, if n equals 3, these are possible values of L. L can take on 0. L can take on 0 or 1. L can take on 0 or 1 or 2, but can't go up to 3 because it can only go up to n minus 1. So L is like a formula that is dependent on n, and it can take on any value from 0 up to n minus 1.
Okay. Thank you.
It's like a game. It's like we're learning the rules of a new game is kind of what's going on here. Yeah. M sub L. M sub L can take on integer values. So this equals integer values, and it's dependent on L. Of from minus L through to 0 through to positive L. So some examples here. If L is 0, then M sub L, the values that M sub L can take on, would be 0. If L is equal to 1, then M sub L can take on minus 1, 0, or positive 1. If L is equal to 2, then M sub L can take on minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. So M sub L, we say, can take on values from 0 all the way through and including plus or minus L. And then the last one is the spin quantum number. And the spin quantum number is M of S. And this one takes on values of only plus or minus 1/2. So it can either be 1/2 or minus 1/2. It is a binary number. It can only take on two values. It is either 1/2 or minus 1/2. And those are the possibilities for the spin quantum number. Okay, that's the complicated part. The complicated part is understanding what all these possible values for each one of these things can be. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take all of these things and we're going to make sense out of them. All right, so here's what this picture looks like. So let's put that aside for a second. If we look at n and we list out n, there are values of n, 1, 2, let me move 2 up a little bit. I'm going to need enough space here. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So these are the values of n. These are the principal quantum numbers. And within each one of these within each one of these principal quantum numbers, we have a level L equal to 0, and then we have M sub L and what M sub L can take on, which is equal to 0. And this is going to be represented by a line. Actually, I don't even want to do it this way. I'm going to do it my way. I'm just trying to do it in a different way, and this is just not going to make enough sense. Let me do it this way. Within the principal quantum level one, there is one thing that we call an orbital. And in this orbital is a location where electrons can reside. And we can think about this as being a certain distance from the nucleus. So we could say that the nucleus is all the way down here. And that in this first level, there is what we would say is sort of one sublevel. And that one sublevel has one shelf where electrons can sit on. And let's think about these for right now like a bookshelf. And each one of these shelves can hold a certain number of electrons. And each shelf can basically hold two electrons. And so what we have here is a shelf that can hold two electrons. In principal energy level two, there are two shelves, but the first shelf has one and the second shelf has three. When we go into the third principal energy level, there are three shelves, and I haven't written the third shelf yet, and I'm going to put the third shelf in here. So this third shelf goes in here, and it has one, two, three, four, five shelves on it. And so let's color code these in order to break them out, and we'll start with sort of a nice neutral color that in principal energy level one, there is one shelf. In principal energy level two, there are two shelves. In principal energy level three, there are three shelves. So we've sort of marked them out. And the way that these shelves relate to the quantum numbers and what I was trying to do before is that this one is L equals zero and that this actual shelf itself is M sub L equal to zero. This first shelf here, this is the L equals zero. This is the L equals one. And the values of M sub L that can be taken on is this is the zero value. The M sub L value here, this is the minus one, the zero, and the plus one. So this is L equals zero, L equals one, and L equals two. And the M sub L values, M sub L equals zero. That needed to be an M sub L there, M subscript L. This is minus one, zero, plus one. And here, M sub L minus two, minus one, zero, plus one, plus two. And this pattern continues such that in principle level four, if I were to go and do level four, I would have to keep adding in pieces. So I would start off at one. Then I would have my level that is here that is three. Then I have a level that is up here that has five. And then there's a level beyond that. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And each one of these would be principal energy level four. And we would have, ooh, that is the wrong thing. We would have L equals zero again, L equals one, L equals two, L equals three. This would be zero, minus one, zero, plus one, minus two, minus one, zero, plus one, plus two. And now when I'm in three, I could go all the way out to minus three. Minus two, minus one, zero, plus one, plus two, and plus three. The same happens for five, six, and seven. And we can build all those patterns. And there's a variable that is missing here. A variable that is missing that I haven't used yet. I've used three of the quantum numbers. I've used N, the principal quantum number. I've used L, the azimuthal quantum number. I've used M sub L, which is the, I can't even remember the name of that one, the magnetic quantum number. And what I have not used yet is I have not used spin. An electron is symbolized by an arrow, either an up arrow or a down arrow. So these symbolize the actual electron. And when the arrow is up, we say that it is spin up. And when the arrow is down, we say that it is spin down. And so that M of S, this is equal to 1/2. And this is M of S equal to -1/2. Every one of these shelves that I have drawn can hold 2 electrons. And so electrons will pack into these shelves as being either spin up or spin down. But once a shelf has 2 electrons on it, it can't hold any more electrons. This is the part where I say that this is like a sculpture, that we're trying to understand what the sculpture looks like. And why does it look this way? This is the way that Mother Nature made it. No matter how many times we measure it, every time we measure it, every time we go through and we do the experiments to measure where these energy levels are and the amount of energy that an electron can take on, we get the same result. And that result is this picture. And this is the electronic structure that happens within an element itself. And this is a two-dimensional representation of that structure. And yet we can go to a three-dimensional representation of the structure. We won't actually do that, but we will look at what these energy levels look like in 3 dimensions. And we can pull those up and look at them a bit later. So Eric, what's the amount, the max amount of shelves that there can be? Vanessa, there is no maximum. N, we generally take it up to 7, but there is an N8, an N9, an N10, and the number of shelves continue and the system continues. So there's no maximum in terms of what maximum shelf they could be. And Eric, so is spin like a half step between shelves? Not exactly. Electrons are negatively charged. And because electrons are negatively charged, they repel one another. And it is a property of an electron that an electron, if we think about it as a, this is a very crude way to think about it and is not reality at all, but it works for our purposes. I can't make a circle for save my life, come on. If we think about a sphere like this, and an electron is actually pretty perfectly round, that sphere can have 2 different ways of spinning. It can spin in an upwards direction, or it can spin in a downwards direction. And so we literally think of that word spin as being the 1/2 and the -1/2 in the ways that the electron can spin. And it can take on these 2 different properties. And when 2 electrons spin the same direction, they repel each other very strongly. But when 2 electrons have opposite spins, they don't attract each other, but they repel less. So they repel each other less when we put them spin opposite. So the spin is a way of packing 2 electrons into an orbital such that they repel each other less. And is there always 2 electrons per shelf, or is that the max electrons per shelf? It is 2 electrons for each shelf. That is the maximum number of electrons that a shelf can take is 2. So, and so we can count how many electrons can go into each principal energy level. But I'm going to save that and not do that just yet. What I want to do is I want to use this picture to talk about the layout of the periodic table. And I want to link the layout of the periodic table to this picture and what these variables mean in terms of N, L, m sub l, and s. And what we're going to do is we're going to relate them to the image on the periodic table, or the image that is the periodic table. And we're going to build an understanding of this structure in an understanding of the table itself. Okay? So let me grab a periodic table, which I did not think to have on hand ahead of time, but I think I can do fairly quickly. There we go. Okay, so we should have a table, except my app froze. Yes, okay, we now have a periodic table. Okay. Element number one, hydrogen. How many electrons does hydrogen have? Can you guys tell me how many electrons hydrogen has?
One.
Just one, right. It has one proton, but that also means that it has one electron. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the electronic configurations for these elements. And the electrons, as we pack them into this picture, so we're going to be packing the electrons into this picture in a more compact sort of way. Electrons are always going to pack in on the lowest possible shelf they can. You can think of this as water in a bathtub, that water is going to fill from the bottom up, and it is always going to seek the lowest possible energy that it can. Electrons are the same way. Electrons are going to fill from the bottom up, seeking the lowest possible energy that they can at each step. So as we start to look at these electronic configurations, we're going to do energy diagrams. And we're going to do each element. So we're going to look at hydrogen, which has one electron. And that one electron is going to go into the first orbital in principal energy level one. And principal energy level two is going to sit up here. And we're going to be able to see principal energy level two. But we're not going to be able to access it just yet. So that one electron is represented here. And the quantum numbers for that first electron are going to be one, because remember this is N. And then we had L. And then we have M sub L. And then we have M sub S. And so our values are going to be 1, 0, 0, and positive 1/2. And that is going to describe the location of where that electron sits. So that electron, this guy, is that electron. When we look at helium, let's go back at our periodic table. And then I'll come back to this picture. So this picture is not going away. I just want to look at where helium is. Helium is over here on the periodic table. How many electrons does helium have?
Two.
Two electrons. So helium with its two electrons, helium is going to fit into the same picture. Except helium's second electron is going to sit here. And so this second electron, that is this electron, is going to have quantum numbers of 1, 0, 0, minus 1/2. is this similar to coordinate system of sorts? It is a coordinate system of sorts, kind of. And it describes its location, not exactly its behavior, although it's going to somewhat, in some ways, describe its behavior. We'll see. Okay, let me ask this. Can I fit any more electrons into principal energy level one? Remember that each orbital, what I'm describing as an orbital, can hold two electrons. So I have filled this energy level, and principal energy level one is now filled. Let's go look at the periodic table again. Notice that what we did is we put one electron from hydrogen and one electron from helium into principal energy level one. And once that was done, principal energy level one was filled, and I needed to start back over the periodic table and start putting electrons into principal energy level two. These numbers that are at the side of the periodic table are, in fact, the principal energy levels. And the table is constructed in terms of principal energy levels. Ooh, I'm seeing light bulbs going on. I'm seeing people smiling. I'm seeing faces going, oh my God, that makes sense. All this crap you've been doing to me. Why didn't you just say that in the beginning? Why didn't you just do that? It would have made so much more sense if you just did that. It's okay. And even if it's not going off for you yet and the light bulbs aren't going off, they will in a minute. Hang tight. Hang with me and it'll start to make sense. No worries. It's going to get there. All right. So what we're looking at here on the periodic table is that these values here are the principal energy levels. Okay. Now, working from that, we're going to go and we're going to start back at lithium and we're going to look at lithium. Lithium has three electrons, so we need to go and put three electrons into an orbital or into the picture. So let's go down and we'll draw and we'll look at lithium starting over in our periodic table here. So here's lithium. Lithium has three electrons and we have one and two. And this picture and the three electrons, the first electron goes here, second electron goes here, third electron goes there. So these electrons, as they pack in, they always go spin up. So some rules. Here are some rules. These rules have names. I'm horrible at the names. I'm horrible at retaining names of these things. But the rules are electrons fill from the bottom up. Number two, the first electron in an orbital always goes spin up. Number three, when you have redundant energy levels, the electrons spread out. We don't pair them unless we have to. So what we mean here is, or what we mean to say is, don't pair electrons unless you have to. Meaning that if I have three orbitals and I'm putting two electrons in, the two electrons will spread out, not this, that electrons, because they repel when they have equal energy levels, the electrons will spread out until such time as the energy level is half full, and then we come back and we start pairing them. So electrons fill from the bottom up. First electron in an orbital is always spin up. Don't pair electrons unless you have to. And I think that's enough of the rules for what we need to be able to do. But we've gone through and we've looked at lithium. Now, I want to I want to go and do something else here that goes back to an earlier experiment that we did. I want to go back to the gas discharge tube and grab that picture for a minute. It's this picture that I want. No, hey, come back. Okay, so this picture, I can put it here. These spectral lines. When these spectral lines were observed, and this was done for hydrogen, the spectral lines were given names. The spectral lines were given sharp for the purple, primary for the blue, diffuse for the sort of aqua line, and fundamental for the red. They were given these because the names were descriptive of the color and the shape of the line that was displayed. And what they did is they took those names, sharp, and they pulled the S from the sharp, and the P from the primary, and the D from diffuse, and the F from fundamental. And they gave these names to what we call the sublevels. So when we look at these quantum numbers, the quantum number N that we call the principal quantum number has some different names. Some of the names that you may have heard. The principal quantum number is also called the shell, is one way to call it. L, the azimuthal quantum number, azimuthal quantum number, is also called the subshell. Sometimes these are called the level or sublevel. All of these things are used sort of interchangeably. The sublevels, when we look at the sublevels that was L equals zero, L equals 1, L equals 2, and all the way up to L equals 3. So I'm going to get L equals 3 in there too. So that was 3, 5, and 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this is L equals 3. This was called an S. This was called a P. This was called a D. And this was called an F. And it was S for sharp, P for primary, D for diffuse, and F for fundamental. And then after this, they decided that this was a crazy system and that it could not be sustained in this way. And because L goes up to much higher values, we can have, my kids need to stop texting me. We can have values that are here that L equals 4. So this was 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. This is L equals 4. And they started to do it alphabetical after this. So after we get L equals 4, we go alphabetical. So it goes S, P, D, F, G, H, I, J, K, and we go that way. So let's see, questions. So these are the levels. These are not the levels, these are the sublevels. The levels are the principal energy levels. So when we go back to the periodic table and we look at the periodic table, we're saying that each row is a principal energy level. The sublevels are what we're starting to build here. This is an S sublevel. This is an S and a P sublevel. So S, S, and P. And what we're going to see is I'm going to switch to a shorter sort of way of filling this out. Let me see, Vanessa, is there a limit of how many electrons can get packed into sublevels before having to move to the next level? Yes, there actually is a limit, and that's why we went through the values of L. Because once we had a value of L, M sub L could take on plus or minus L all the way through plus L to minus L through the integer values. And so it goes up by 2 every time. Notice that as I was writing out these levels, the number of sublevels is that that there is one orbital. There are 3 orbitals. There are 5 orbitals. There are 7 orbitals. There are 9 orbitals. The number is going up by 2 each time. So an S has 1, a P has 3, a D has 5, an F has 7, a G has 9, an H would have 11. I would have 13. They go up by 2 every time. And that's because of the formula that we introduced before that tells you that M sub L can take on values of all integer values between plus or minus L. And that's how they go. Okay. Looking at my time and seeing, so lithium would be, 2, 1, minus 1, 1/2. For the last electron in lithium, where were we? For this electron in lithium, this electron would be principal energy level 2. It would be in a 0, also in a 0. And a positive 1/2. That would be that electron, because we would be in principal energy level 2 in L0. M sub L would be 0, and the spin would be positive 1/2. So that's what that would be. All right, I want to make some more connections here yet, though. And I haven't made all the connections that I want to make, and I want to make some more connections. So what we're doing is we're breaking down these values, and we're saying that we're going to relate N to the principal value. So N is going to be, we're going to call it the principal level or the level, and that these are equal to the rows in the periodic table, or the periods, which are the rows in the periodic table. L, we're going to call the sublevel. And L can take on values of S, P, D, F, and then G, H, alphabetical from there. And that when we look at amps of L, that these are going to be called the orbitals. And the orbitals, an S orbital or an S sublevel can have 1 orbital. A P sublevel can have 3 orbitals. A D sublevel can have 5 orbitals. A F can have 7. And when we look at amps of S, the spin quantum number, we're not going to relate that. We're going to relate that to either an up or down in terms of the electron itself. But when we look at the number of electrons, so if we track the number of electrons allowed in a sublevel, it is 2 electrons per each. So it is 2 electrons that can fit in here, 2, 4, 6 electrons that can fit into that sublevel. It is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 electrons that can fit into a D sublevel, and 14 electrons that can fit into an F sublevel. It's always 2 times the number that's in the sublevel. So now we have a language that is going to use all kinds of different words. We've got levels, which will be N. We've got sublevels, which are L. Those sublevels are referred to specifically by name as S, P, D, F, G, H. Each one of those sublevels is broken down into a series of orbitals. The number of orbitals is relative to what the sublevel is, and each sublevel can hold a certain number of electrons, which is twice the number of orbitals in there. That still may be confusing. We're going to make some more light bulbs go off. So here we go for some more light bulbs. Our S and P skipped later on down the alphabet. We never get that far, Eric. Nice concern, but we don't have enough electrons to get that far. So it doesn't become a problem. Let's go back to the periodic table, and I am going to now track these electrons in the periodic table in a slightly different way than I've been doing. And we've done hydrogen and helium. We're going to go do lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and neon. Let's do it. And I might need to bring that periodic table back in here one more time. In fact, I'm going to do that now. Let's copy and bring it back down. Perfect. It'll put it in the page below me, right where I can get to it easily. All right. So here's the image of what we have. And we're going to do this in a slightly faster manner now. Here's hydrogen. And here's the one S and the two S and the two P. Here is helium and the one S and the two S and P. We had already put the one electron in for hydrogen and the two electrons in for helium. And then we started back over on the periodic table and we started with lithium. And so we started at the next row. And here's our S, one S, two S, and the two P. Lithium has three electrons. Ooh, trying to do arrows and it's not working. My brain is trying to do something that I do normally a shortcut way. And I'll show you the shortcut in a little bit. This needs to go just a scooch higher. And this whole thing needs to come down just a scooch lower. From lithium, we go to beryllium. And beryllium, so this had three electrons. Beryllium has four electrons. So here's my 1s, 2s, and p. One electron, two electrons, three electrons, four electrons. Notice that I have filled this block, and that this block is filled, and the next electron, as I go over to boron, boron having five electrons in the periodic table, is going to need to move up into that next block. So this is principal energy level one and two, the 1s, the 2s, and the 2p. Boron's five electrons, first electron, second electron, third, fourth, fifth. I have jumped from the 2s to the 2p and I'm starting to fill a new block. Let's go look at the periodic table. When we filled hydrogen and helium, we needed to start back over with lithium at period two. And period two started principal energy level two. I filled lithium and beryllium, and then I had to jump to a new orbital in order to start filling boron. Notice the jump in the table. The jump in the table is where I'm jumping from S to starting to fill P. And the jump in the table corresponds to a jump in energy to a new sublevel. And in fact, if I take a look at the S sublevel, how many electrons can the S sublevel hold? S sublevel can hold two electrons. Notice the block in the table here that is 2 electrons wide. This block is 2 electrons wide because this is where I am filling S sublevels. So this block that is here, this is called the S block. And it is 2 elements wide because it is where you are filling S orbitals. I said that when I got to boron, that last electron in boron, here it is, needed to go into the 2p orbital. How many electrons can fit into the 2p orbitals, into the p sublevel? It is 2 plus 2 plus 2, 6 totally. How many elements wide is this block? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This block is where I'm filling p sublevels.
You can continue to see that increase as you go down the periodic table.
Absolutely. So this is the P block. And it is 6 elements wide for the 6 electrons that the P orbitals can hold. We don't have it, or I haven't drawn it yet, but we had it up here. D, how many electrons can the D orbital hold? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, right? Look down here at the periodic table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Oh, cool.
This is the D block. And it is 10 elements wide. The F block can hold 14 elements or 14 electrons for 14 elements. Where do I see a block that is 14 elements wide?
The bottom detached.
Yeah, that's the F block. So down here, this is the F block and is 14 elements wide. For the 14 electrons. Now, it's actually technically 15 because they bring lanthanum and actinum down, the lanthanum and actinum, and they call this the lanthanum series and the actinum series. Lanthanum and actinum actually belong up here in the periodic table in the D block, and then it is the remaining 14 that are actually the 14 elements of the F block. So sometimes you will see it as 15 elements wide, but that's what it is. And so we have these broad blocks now that we can say that this is the S block, and the S block includes these guys right here. And then we can go to the P block, and the P block elements are these guys. I'm leaving out helium on purpose because helium is in period one and doesn't have P's. And then the D block, as I get to it, the D block is 10 elements wide and is this block right here. I'll actually include those guys there too. So the layout of the periodic table is built in electronic structure, and you can tell the electronic structure from any element just by where it's sitting. Can we do the shelves of carbon if time? Yes, we can get through carbon, I think. Oh, yeah, we're at boron. Let me go through, and we go from boron, we go to carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and neon. And I'm going to get this into the notes, but I'm going to do it in a tight sort of way. So I'm gonna just make my lines a little bit neater. And this is my 1s, my 2s, and p. And what I will do is I will copy this. And through the magic of copy and paste, and I'll get rid of those because we don't really need those as we go through. Oh, I know how I can do it. I can make it even tighter. This is my 1s, my 2s, my 2p. 1s, 2s, 2p. copy, paste for each one of these. And we were at 5 electrons. We are now at 6 electrons, 7 electrons, 8 electrons, 9 electrons, and 10 electrons. 2, 4, 5, 6 for carbon. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7 for nitrogen. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7 come back in pair, 8 for oxygen. Nine for fluorine. And then notice for neon, at neon, I'm at the end of the table. And once I hit neon at the end of the table, principal energy level is filled. And so there's neon at the end of the table. Principal energy level 2 is filled. I need to go back and restart principal energy level 3, and the table starts over again. And I start filling in the S block, and then I go to the P block. And I do it all over again in a repeating pattern that is the periodic table. So on Monday, when we go through, we have learned the essence of this. Monday, what we'll go through is we'll go through some shortcuts of how we can write electronic configurations in a shorthand notation. We'll learn that shorthand notation. We'll coordinate it with the periodic table a little bit more. And then we'll start to look at ions, electrons that gain or lose electrons, and why they gain or lose electrons, and how we can see why they would gain or lose electrons from the layout of the periodic table, and the ions will then start to make sense. From there, once we go to ions, then we start actually using the elements that are ions to make ionic compounds, and we actually start to begin to look at how matter combines to form ionic compounds, and then we'll start to get into actual chemical equations and how matter can change up and trade and do all sorts of different types of chemical equations and things. That's the progression that we wind up going through. So I know that this was sort of a quick introduction into electronic configurations. And I know I bounce back and forth between very pure sort of chemistry, techno-speak with the quantum numbers. And then I bridged into the more sort of slang way that we refer to the orbitals and the sublevels and the levels. And we'll try to bring it all together and hit it a little bit more home. But I'm hoping that some of those light bulbs went off as we were looking at the periodic table and the structure and why there's these gaps that are in the table. And the gaps are there because of the jumping of the energy levels as we move from one block to another in the periodic table. Okay? So that's where I wanted to hit today. I'm 5 minutes over. I'm happy to stay on the line and answer any questions that anybody has. I'm also happy that if you don't have any questions, to say, have a good weekend. And cool. Eric, nice comments. All right. So anybody can log off as they want. Have a great weekend. And I'll stay on the line and answer any questions that you've got. You guys are welcome. Yeah, and remember. Okay, Kerrigan, go for it.
So would you like us to know this like quite literally or more figuratively at this point?
That's a good question. I think that I was trying to bridge the gap between Chem 3 and Chem 1A so that at the Chem 3 level, we mainly look at it not as quantum numbers, but we look at it as principal energy levels and sublevels, which we call the SPDF sublevels, and then the number of orbitals that fit within that sublevel. That's pretty much the extent of what you need to operate within Chem 3. When you go to Chem 1A, they will ask you about the allowable quantum numbers. And so they will give you quantum numbers and write them out and ask you which ones are allowable and which ones are not. And they really want you to learn them at the quantum number level thing. And so I introduce it from that standpoint and the rules so that you'll be more successful as you go to Chem 1A and not feeling so lost as as those come into play. But I don't anticipate asking you to fill out the quantum numbers themselves or to ask you which ones are allowable. I'm going to function more at the SPDF sort of level.
Okay.
In the more familiar sort of level.
Okay, cool. Okay. Yes. And then I've never been to the afternoon lab, but since I was working this morning and I got back early, I'd like to go to lab. So
okay.
Is it the same link?
Yes. It's cool. It's the exact same length. It starts at 1 o'clock and it goes till 3.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much.
And do you have the link or do you see the link in your email to that?
I have the link. Well, I have the number that gets you into the
afternoon one?
The chat room on Zoom for the morning.
Yeah, so let me give you it's not the same number. Let me give you a different link.
Okay, cool.
There, I threw it into the chat. So the number is the 959-8068-8382.
Cool. Thank you.
So that's for the afternoon.
Thank you so much. I will see you there.
Okay. You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jason?
Yeah. Vanessa?
Hi. I'm kind of slowly getting my head wrapped around this.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused still as to like the sublevels once they all fill up. Like at what point do we move on to a new principal energy level? Like at what point?
We move on to a new principal energy level every time we hit the end of the periodic table. So when we hit at an element of the noble gases, we start over in a new principal energy level.
Okay.
It'll become a little bit more clear, Vanessa, when we do some more exercises, and I'm gonna send out an exercise that I want you guys to work on too that is gonna help with that.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so I do admit that it certainly could be fuzzy leaving this lecture, and you may not fully appreciate or understand how to go through and fill the energy levels. By the next lecture, it should help a whole lot.
Yeah, I probably just have to sleep over it a few nights and then.
Okay. Yeah. And play with it. It's going to take some practice. And so having you guys fill out some energy levels and actually do it on your own rather than watching it will make more sense.
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
You're welcome. You too. Okay. Are there any other questions, you guys, or can I go ahead and log it off?
I had a question about the last problem that we did in the lab. I just wanted to know what the answer was to see if I got it right.
Okay, Emily, it was, 2.12 grams.
Okay, carbon. Perfect. I got it right. I just want to double check.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Nice work.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
You too.
Yes. Okay, Annalise, I'm going to guess that maybe you're not there, and I'm going to go ahead and end the section. All right, we will see you later.